episode 18 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemiss, and my co-host, as always, is David Grigg. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm not too bad. A bit chilly this morning, which is rather surprising given the weather we've had recently, but never mind. That's just Melbourne.
We've had an extremely hot summer, and
we certainly have,
and it's cold and raining, which is a blessing in disguise, given that we have all these currently afflicted in this state and also in other states in Australia by these massive bushfires.
Yes.
Which has been a bit of a problem. I've even got the smell of wet ash in the air around here today.
Yes.
And a couple of days has been very misty and hazy overhead, and it's not haze, as a certain Prime Minister would like to say. It is actually smoke.
Yep.
And to denigrate it down to haze, I think, is missing the point a bit. Mm. But anyway, it's not terribly good, and we've... We know somebody who's been badly affected by these as well, haven't we?
Yes, we have a friend, Don Ashby, who lives in Mallacoota, has lived in Mallacoota for quite some time. And Mallacoota is the little coastal town in far east Victoria that was surrounded by flames, and everyone had to evacuate to the beach to be prepared to leap into the water as the flames tore the town apart. Didn't quite get that bad. But sad to say, Don and his partner have lost their house as part of the fires, and so he's now homeless. But he's been doing a sterling job, from what I can gather from a number of media outlets, in keeping people informed and helping organise aid at the local hall. So good on him, and we hope everybody stays safe down there.
Yes, it's been it's like a war zone down there at the moment. It's terrible.
Yeah.
But at least he's safe.
Yes,
it's very sad news that he's lost his house, but the thing of it is that he and his family are safe, and that's the major thing. Houses can be rebuilt, even though it's a heartbreaking problem to have to go through. It can be done.
Yeah, indeed.
But it's good to hear.
Yeah. We've been talking, perhaps a little too flippantly, about the terrible bushfires that have been devastating large parts of Australia. What some of our listeners may not know is that much of the firefighting has been done by volunteer organisations like the Country Fire Authority in Victoria and the Rural Fire Service in New South Wales. Though they're partly supported by government, they really appreciate any donations from the public. So we'll put links in the show notes to places you can donate if you'd like to. So we'll go on and we'll start thinking about what we were reading last year, I think. That's our plan for the episode. So I thought if I might start, and we'll just have a bit of rundown of my overall reading through the year. Now, I know you read far more books than I do, Perry, but I managed to get to a total of 74 this year. I was aiming for 80, but I got to 74. And my excuse for not hitting 80 is that some of the books I read this year were pretty long. And I'll explain those as I go
come
through.
Come on.
I will explain that.
That's quibbly.
Fair enough. Well, it's easier to read, half a dozen short books than it is to read one long one. Anyway, I won't make excuses. So I did a bit of an analysis. I thought it might be interesting to sort of see what kinds of things I was reading. And if you look at the sort of genre, it really breaks down pretty well into thirds. About a third of what I read was science fiction or fantasy, which I've sort of lumped together in my analysis. About a third was crime, mystery, thriller, which again I've lumped together in my calculations. And the other third was things like what I would call non-genre fiction or literary fiction, whatever you like. One historical fiction book and one anthology. So that's the breakdown of what I read. And I also thought it might be interesting to have a think about the format of those books. And it breaks down to about 60% digital books, ebooks, and so on, and about 40% actual physical paper books. And I thought that was just interesting. I don't know how your breakdown would match up with that.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I would have thought. See, I would have thought that I would have you pegged it. Yeah, probably more on the paper side, but I can certainly understand that we are moving with the times, getting into the e-reader idea, because it's a lot easier to be able to cart around a large number of books yep. in one place in an e-reader. I certainly find that when I'm traveling, that gone are the days when I have to lug around seven or eight books and try and work out which ones myself and my wife are going to read, so that we don't carry books around that only one of us is going to read. But now I can take hundreds or thousands all in one little device, and it makes things a heck of a lot easier. And if you're traveling on public transport, for example, it's just a lot easier to have an e-reader kick it off. But it's so 60% digital and 40%
paperback. Paperback, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I was actually pretty close to that. I read 108 for the year. I'm down on what I was last year because the way I look at it is I had a couple of months where I was traveling and basically I didn't really have any spare time. I was just all flat out traveling the whole time. And by the time I got back to the hotel in the evening, I was exhausted, just collapsed. Yes. And then up again in the morning and off again the next day. And so I'm not big on, I'm also not big on listening to audio books. It's a medium that I haven't got into just as yet. Maybe I'll have to sometime in the future. But of that 108, 65 were digital and 43 were on paper. So it's pretty close to what to what you had. So it's about 60-40. Yeah, that's pretty close. It's quite interesting the way that worked out. Overall, sure. I read, let's see. Well, I put – one thing that you have to remember is that I read not only novels but also novellas published in book four. Some of these are going to be a touch under 100 pages, but a lot are around the 120 to 150 page mark. Now, as we've discussed previously, some of these novellas are pretty much like old short novels, you know, sort of science fiction short novels. My grand novels are only around 120 to 140 pages long. If you have a look at the Sherlock Holmes novels, they're only about 120 to 140, at least the first couple. Yeah. Study in Scarlet's only about that.
Yes, now, some novellas, yeah.
Yeah, some people would basically put those as novellas, but the way I look at it is because it's published as a separate volume, that's the way I look at it. If I'm reading a novella in an anthology that's not published separately, I don't count that as being a separate book. I count that as being included in the anthology that's there. So that's where my change comes to. So I read what I would consider literary books 14 last year. There were 34 SF, 20 fantasy, 4 that covered both because they were basically anthologies, 4 horror novels, 22 crime, 3 thriller and spy, and 7 non-fiction, which if my all singing, all dancing spreadsheet, which I've shown you at some stage.
It's very complicated. Very complicated.
It is very complicated. That comes up to 108.
Well, there you go.
So that's not bad. And of those, there were 70 novels, 18 novellas, 4 single author collections, 9 anthologies, and 7 non-fiction books, and 19 of the books were over 400 pages. I look at 400 pages as being a sort of a cutoff, as being my bottom end of my brick level, if you like. So I was down a bit on the numbers for last year. I also set a whole lot of targets for the year. So I had a target of 96, so I got over that. I've increased that by another 6 this coming year. I like to sort of push myself a little bit, and I've got this long-term plan to get it out to 120 on a regular basis per year. So once I get to that, I'll plateau the target, because anything higher than that, I'm going to really struggle.
Becomes silly, yes.
Well, it does, but 120, I reckon, is pretty good. Although some people we know that live in Melbourne and review science fiction books are up to setting targets of 140, 150, which I find mind-boggling. So that's like 3 a week, one every 2 days. So I think you pretty much give up film and television if you're going to be doing that completely.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to be doing a lot of you're going to be doing a lot of reading.
Indeed.
So I also have other targets, not many of which I'll go into here because there's just so many of them that I put in as individual targets. Like I set myself targets to try and read a certain number of the Miles Franklin Award winners, which is Australia's major literary award, a certain number of Hugo Awards, Nebula Award winners, Man Booker Prize winners, all those sorts of individuals. Some of them I hit, some of them I didn't. But I like to go with the idea of having a target, so it keeps on reminding me all the time, oh, look, don't forget, you've got to actually pick up a book that's a Booker Prize winner coming up soon and make sure you read those. Because as we've discussed previously, David, I think that I've got an opportunity at my age of life to be able to read these things once more.
Yes.
If I get to the chance where I've read everything, that I want to read. That's not likely to happen. I wouldn't have thought. Maybe I can go back and hit some of those other ones again. But frankly, I've got one shot. So I reckon I'm just going to try and work my way through and try and catch up with all that backlog that is just piled up all over.
Fair enough. Well, I don't set quotas like you do, but I can see how it would be an advantage if you've got, you know, five dozen books on your wanted to read list and you're trying to decide which book to read next. Then that's a good way to control that, I guess. So that's useful.
It also gives you the point though that you can push yourself to basically remind yourself that okay, let's not be male-centric about all the authors that we read. Yeah. We have to try and ensure that we get as good a balance as we can. Let's also try and add in translated fiction because mm-hmm. that's one thing that when we live in a country like Australia where it's English-dominated, you have to be careful that you're keeping up with what's going on in other parts of the world. And as long as they were written in a foreign language first and translated into English later, I'm not saying that I'm going to learn French to be able to learn French, not read French novels. I'm just going to basically try and read books that have been translated from French, from German, Spanish, Icelandic, all the rest of them that you can think of. And I just think that it's it gives you a better perspective of what's happening around the world and keeps up with what's going on. So that's why I set those targets. It can come across as being very, very anal, as you've seen. It's pretty ridiculous. But it helps me keep on track in terms of where I want to go.
Fair enough. All right, so we're going to now go through each of the major genres that we've been reading and sort of try to pick. We're trying to pick sort of the best five, I think, isn't that the idea, Perry?
Yeah.
In each of those categories. And I did think that we sort of do it as a bit of a countdown, but I'm not sure that's going to work. So we'll see how we go anyway. I'll sort of start off and we'll see how it pans out. So if we look at the science fiction and fantasy genres, I've put those together because in lots of ways I find it hard to distinguish between science fiction and fantasy for some books. And in fact, some of the best books I read this year are right on the borderline, I think, of between the two genres. So I'm not trying to split between them, so we'll just go from there. So I'll try and do a bit of a countdown thing. So number five out of my best SF and fantasy this year was Bitter Seeds by Ian Tregillis. And I talked for rather too long in episode 13 about this, about the what's called the Milkweed Triptych by Ian Tregillis. And Bitter Seeds is the first volume of that. I haven't added the second and third volumes in to my best five, but we'll just go with this one to indicate that trilogy. Very briefly, again, I won't talk very long about it. Very briefly, it's set in an alternate version of World War II and features a very dark concept of these Nazi scientists who are raising children and surgically altering them to give them kind of superhero type powers. And on the British side, to counter that threat, there are a group of warlocks who are manipulating these mysterious, powerful and quite malevolent entities called Eidolons to oppose them. But it's a very cleverly done. It's actually much better written than that sounds. And I like the whole series of them, but this was the particular, it was the first one, so I thought I'd pick that. Okay, so next on my list, number four, counting down, was Neverwhere, which I talked about in episode 16. That's Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman, in an illustrated version by Chris Riddle. And again, I'm not going to talk for any great length about this because we've talked about it before, but just a clever bit of fantasy. This is fantasy, I think, where someone is taken out of the everyday world and taken to London Underground, where strange things happen, and he has to go through the hero's journey and conquer himself and conquer his demons in order to come out of it a better person. So I very much enjoyed that. And that was good. So next in my list, coming up to number three, again, I talked about this back in our second episode, and it was, I picked up, this is The Power by Naomi Alderman. And I think I said then that I picked up because I saw it on Barack Obama's recommended reading list, and he's got good taste, that man. Mm-hmm. So this was the book which is set pretty much in the modern day, with the interesting premise that women start to evolve an organ which gives them the ability to deliver severe electric shocks like electric eels do. And the whole point of this is that for the first time in history, women are more physically powerful than men. And this then begins to change things very radically in society. It's a perhaps an absurd concept, but it's clever, and it's a good way of holding up a mirror to our current gender assumptions, which I thought was good. And then we come to two novels by Claire North, and she was my discovery of the year, really, the literary highlight of the year, discovering her books. So Perry and I talked quite a bit about the first 15 lives of Harry August some episodes ago, and again, just very clever concept of some group of people who kind of live their lives again. They go through their lives and die, and then they wake up as a child again and slowly start to recover memories of their previous life or previous run through this particular life. But they're still able to make changes, and so that they have agency and are able to change how the world turns out. It's a very clever concept, and then she builds on that with all sorts of extra plot plot elements, which it was just a really, really good book. And then my very best in this category for the year was her book, Claire North's book, The Sudden Appearance of Hope. I like this a bit more than Perry does, but I just thought this was fantastic as I read it. It was only halfway through it, and I thought, this has got to be on my top five of the year list. So I'll just briefly cover this one. So it's, and again, I've spoken about it before, so I won't talk too long. But basically, the premise is that there's this young woman who's a mixed race young woman. She's got mixed parentage, and she has dark skin. She starts getting forgotten. People start forgetting her. In fact, when she becomes an adult, when she grows to maturity, no one can ever remember meeting her, or indeed anything about any encounters they've had with her. And she actually manages to kind of turn that into kind of a superpower, and it enables her to steal pretty much with impunity, or to spy on people without getting caught. Because she might get caught, but all she has to do is distract someone's attention for something like a minute or two, and then they forget her. So the guards forget that they've got a hold of her, and she can be put into a room, and they forget that she's there. And so it does give her this kind of power. But then Claire North turns the screw again and again and again, and it becomes much more complex. And she introduces a determined female character who calls herself Byron, who's kind of like an urban terrorist in some ways, trying to bring down a large corporation. And she starts off kind of as an ally of the protagonist, Hope. And how they actually interact, despite Hope getting forgotten all the time, is really, really cleverly done. She just keeps on turning the screw and making it more and more interesting. And the other thing I liked about it was the way that the author shows how much of a curse this problem is for Hope. It condemns her to essentially to eternal loneliness. She can't ever make friends or have relationships with people, but she manages to conquer that and function despite that. I just thought it was a great book. So that was definitely my best SF fantasy of the year. What about you, Perry?
There's some good ones in there, but as you might expect, absolutely no overlap whatsoever.
That's all right.
Okay, well, look, I don't put my best of the year in ranked order. I can understand why you would do that, but I don't. I just put mine in reading order. I just pick the top five and just don't try and give them a numerical ranking, just in terms of when they were they're listed in the order in which they were read.
Okay, that's basically fine. Well, that's probably a sensible way to do it.
So my first one's Blackfish City by Sam J. Miller, 2018 novel. This was the winner of the 2018 John W. Campbell Memorial Award and a finalist for the Locus Award for Best SF Novel in 2019. Didn't get nominated for any other awards, which I thought was quite peculiar. Sam Miller is quite an excellent short story writer, and he's written a couple of young adult novels prior to this, but this was his first adult SF novel, and I thought it was pretty damn good. There was some problems, but I thought it was okay. It's a novel set post climate change in a floating city in the Arctic, and it's what happens to that particular city because it's a closed environment, what sort of things go on, what sort of level of corruption is undertaken. It's almost becomes like a mobster novel in some ways because there are certain elements who are trying to control things. And then, of course, somebody comes in from outside who upsets the balance completely, and you just follow what happens from there. I thought it was excellent. I thought it was very good. Just unfortunate I didn't think it got the notice that it deserved. We didn't discuss this in any of the podcast episodes because I read it pretty early in the year. But hopefully this year we'll cover all the good ones and I won't need to be able to say that again.
Indeed.
My second one is Red Moon by Kim Stanley Robinson. I know you and I have discussed this. You don't particularly like Stan Robinson's style. No. I do. I quite like it. This is another 2018 novel. Again, it didn't get much recognition. It was a finalist for the Locus Award for Best SF Novel, but then Locus have 10 on their list as opposed to the normal 5 or 6, so those peripheral novels have a better chance of getting nominated in or becoming a finalist for that award. This is the one which talks about China's gradual colonisation of the moon, set in 2047, and what are the implications when a visiting American physicist happens to be on the scene when a Chinese politician is assassinated. The ramifications for that particular physicist, for the people that he knows, the Chinese people that he knows, and for the non-Chinese people, are widespread. The novel covers takes place on both the moon and on Earth. I think it's quite an interesting exploration of what will probably be happening over the next 40 or 50 years in terms of lunar colonization. There's been quite a lot of lunar novels written over the last few years, and I think it's becoming more and more of a topic that we're probably going to have to cover at some point, but I'm a fair way behind on a lot of those. So anyway, my third one was The Calculating Stars by Mary Robinette Cowell, another 2018 novel. Seems to be 2018 was the year for me this year, because four out of the five were from that year. We discussed this in the podcast. This is an alternate history depicting an expanded space race in the 1950s as a result of a massive meteorite strike off the east coast of the US. It won the 2019 Hugo Nebula and Locust SF Awards. So it sort of swept the field pretty much for those particular awards. I think that in other years, this would not have made my top five, which is why I think, and which I'll come to when I talk about my SF overview at the end after I finish this, I'll get to that point in a minute. The last one is, the fourth one, Fahrenheit 451 from 1953 by Ray Bradbury.
Mm-hmm.
We discussed this pretty heavily.
We do.
I don't think this needs any introduction whatsoever. I think it's still very, very relevant now, you know, almost 60 years after it was written. It still holds sway and it's still a very, very important book. I would guess that if I was going to choose one of the five as being my top one, it would be Fahrenheit 451.
Really? Wow.
The last one is Embers of War, another 2018 novel by Gareth Powell. This is a space opera, first in a series. It was the winner of the 2019 BSFA Best Novel Award and a finalist for the Locust Award for Best SF Novel.
Uh-huh.
So another one that fitted into that run. A good, interesting novel, which I think we discussed on the podcast. The BSFA award has a tendency to come up with winners that are slightly different to the Hugos and Nebulas, and for that reason, I think it's worthwhile keeping an eye on that particular award.
Yeah,
it brings up that one and the Clark bring up some rather interesting little topics and little titles that are worthwhile looking at.
Plus, they also tend to concentrate a bit more on British science fiction, of course, than American. That can be refreshing in its own way.
Yes, it can. Now, I've got two honourable mentions, two books I liked.
Oh, yeah.
For different reasons. The first of mine is The Road to Corlay from 1978 by Richard Cowper. Cowper is an excellent novelist. This is sort of on the borderline with your stuff, whether it's going to be SF or whether it's going to be SF or fantasy. But the interesting thing about this book is it is set in the year, in around the years 3000, when Great Britain has been divided into seven kingdoms by the rising seas.
Mm-hmm.
So he was aware of the possibility of climate change, and he wrote this back in the 1970s. So the whole idea of climate change is not a new topic. It has been around, and SF writers have been dealing with it for 40, almost 50 years now. I'm aware that Le Guin's Lathe of Heaven is also deals with it because Antarctica, I believe, is starting to be colonised in that novel, and she talks about the rising sea levels. And that was in the early 70s, so we're talking 50 years back now. And the other one, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Again, this is one of my read-throughs, going back and rereading books that I'm going to have one more shot at. It wasn't in my top five because, well, the trouble is it seems tired now. We know of all the bits about the book, and there's nothing new in it that I can think of to talk about. And so it's unfortunate that the second time round, sometimes when you come to a novel, that because it's been in your consciousness and in the genre, and it's such a big part of the genre for so long, you read it again and you go, okay.
Yeah.
But because you're not reading it fresh,
this
is a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
But
and things are of their time too. I think that's the other thing.
Yeah,
you know, the books are sort of belong to a particular era. Yeah. So have you done with your SF now then? Because
I'm done with the SF.
I forgot that I was going to give some honourable mentions. So if I can just fit mine in, and then you can talk about fantasy. So,
yeah, all right.
The one book I should have mentioned in my honourable mentions for science fiction fantasy was the most recent James S.A. Corey book, part of the Expanse series, which was Tiamat's Wrath. So I thought it was very good, perhaps not the best book in this series so far, but still pretty good, and I'm very much looking forward to the next one. And the other book in my honourable mentions was The Mechanical by Ian Tregillis again, and that's the start of yet another trilogy by him, which called The Alchemy Wars. And I won't go into any great length about it because I've discussed it on the podcast, but that was definitely one of my better reads during the year. So that's me for SF and fantasy.
All right. Okay, fantasy for me. I only read 9 fantasy novels this year, although I read probably about another 8 or 10 fantasy novellas. So I could really only come up with 4 that I would put in my best of the year list. I don't feel as though I have to put a top 5.
No.
If I can't think of one which I think fits in there, I'm just not going to put it in. So the 4 that I've got are Summer Long from 2016 by Peter S. Beagle, Beagle's probably best known for his novel, The Last Unicorn, which was written, I don't know, 70s, something like that, long time ago. But he's still putting out pretty damn good books. This one's deals with a mystical creature in the form of a young woman who comes to live in Puget Sound up by Seattle. And the novel explores the changes undergone by her new friends due to her presence. It's really quite a good, excellent book. I won't give you any more further details. It would need a lot of discussion to go into it. But I thought it was good. Beagle is in good form. It reads really well. There are a number of those fantasy writers that have been around for quite some time that, you know, are still putting out really decent works that are worthwhile getting to. And hopefully during the year, we'll come across a few more of those. My second one is Spinning Silver from 2018 by Naomi Novik. We discussed this one on the podcast, especially when I was talking about what I was going to nominate for the Hugos. And this one was also nominated for a Hugo Award. And it was the winner of the 2019 Locus Award for Best Fantasy Novel. And it's a novel loosely based on the tale of Rumpelstiltskin, not quite as good as her previous reimagining of fairy tales called Uprooted, but still worth reading if you're into fantasy, that is. Third one, Fire and Blood, 2018 by George R. R. Martin. This is this big, massive fictional history of his invented world of or country of Westeros from the Game of Thrones series. I was impressed just purely and simply by the level of imagination and the amount of bloody work the poor bastard did to get it out. Most people would say, well, I wish he'd put the work in it, but we won't do that. We've been there. We won't go into that again. I just thought it was pretty good, worth it, absolutely worth reading. My fourth and last in this category is Witchmark, 2018, again, by C.L. Polk. I discussed this episode or two ago. It was the winner of the 2019 World Fantasy Award for Best Novel and also nominated for a Nebula Award. It's set in an alternate Europe on the brink of war, in a world in which magic exists, but it exists in a way which is being exploited by one class over another. Pretty good, worthwhile. It's the first of a new series, and it was good enough for me to carry on, and I'll keep an eye out for the following books in that series and keep up to date with it. But no honourable mentions for me. The rest of them were, so-so, but that's about it. So that's it for my best fantasy.
Okay. All right. Well, do we want to go to, I had on my list, I was going to go to what I call literary genre or sort of non-genre, non-genre.
Mainstream, sometimes called, or literary,
something
whatever
like
you
like. So, all right, well, I won't try to list them in particular order then. That seems to be probably sensible not to worry about that, but I'll just go through them roughly. Now, the other thing I should say is that a number of these, two of the books I've picked for this category were productions I did for Standard eBooks. And I've talked about Standard eBooks in the past. They're an organisation which produces nicely formatted public domain books. But it's a good excuse for me to read classics, classic novels, because I have to read the book proofread the book as part of the process of producing them. So
you do actually set yourself targets, even though you aren't realising you're doing it.
I suppose so. But anyway,
I'm only trying to give you a hard time, David. Don't worry about it.
Well, only in the sense that, I did 15 books last year for Standard eBooks.
Cool.
15 productions. Yeah, it's a lot. So two of them hit my best of list. And one of them was a book by H.G. Wells, and not one of his scientific fantasies, but one called Tono Bungay. I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but...
No, don't know this one at all.
It's actually a very good book. It's semi-autobiographical, and it has some kind of absurdist elements to it, in that it's all written from the first-person point of view of this protagonist who is raised as the child of a servant, in fact, the housekeeper, in a big estate in England. And isn't treated very well by the um, by the aristocrats who run the place, and eventually gets sent off because he's done something bad. He gets sent off to live with relatives, ends up eventually with living with his uncle, who's a pharmacist or a chemist, if you like, a pharmacist in a small little town. And this guy's got ideas. He's got brilliant ideas, and he wants to come up with some scheme to make money. And eventually he does. He comes up with this quack patent medicine called Tono Bungay. And he's such a genius at marketing this that he, in fact, becomes very, very rich and makes his nephew, George, who's the protagonist, very rich too. But it's like all those things, it comes and goes. It has a peak and then falls away again. But he's the rest of the book is really, it's a very interesting book in terms of the close analysis of relationships between men and women. The protagonist has an unwise marriage, gets divorced, has a bit of an affair, and then he meets up again with someone from his childhood. And then there's a great deal of commentary about the social setup, the class system, and the way that commerce works. Because a lot of this stuff about Tono Bungay is a bit of a satirical look at the way that people can be fooled by advertising and take off from there. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great book, and I can recommend it to you as a classic to be read. But it's not The Island of Dr. Moreau or The Invisible Man, but it's certainly very well worth reading. The other book I did for Standard Books, which I won't spend a long time talking about, was Middlemarch by George Eliot. And it's the first George Eliot book I've ever read. I sort of heard of George Eliot as a writer, and I've read quite a few Victorian-era novelists, but I hadn't read anything of hers. And I was very pleasantly surprised in reading Middlemarch, which is it's really set around a small provincial town and the various relationships between people in the town, and has some very interesting characters, including a young woman who makes an unwise marriage really to a much older man, who in the thought that she's going to be treated as an intellectual equal by him and help him with his studies, but in fact that doesn't work out. That's certainly also very well worth reading. What else have we got? One of them is All the Light We Cannot See, which I did talk about on the podcast quite some time ago. I won't go into any great detail about it, but it actually won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 2015. And it's really the parallel stories or the intertwined stories of an orphaned German boy who's raised in a coal mining district before the war, and when the war starts, gets picked up really by the Nazi party because of his talent. And that's one element to it. And then the other element is a blind girl, a young French girl who becomes blind at the age of 6, and she's raised by her father. And they have to escape the Nazi invasion of Paris and then the rest of France during the war. And these two stories are very cleverly intertwined, and the writing is just beautiful. It's just really, really well written. So that's another great one. And the last one I've got in this category, which is probably the top of the category for me, is a book I talked about in our very first episode, Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton. So again, I won't talk at any great length about it, but it's an Australian novel. Main character is a child of drug dealer parents in a rough suburb of Brisbane. He has an ex-convict as his babysitter, and he has an older brother who is quite strange. He doesn't speak except in very oracular sort of statements like, "Your end is a dead blue wren," or "Boy swallows universe." But eventually all those phrases actually make sense. It's just a beautifully, beautifully done novel, well worth reading. Got a terrific Australian author. And so that was the top of my list in that category. And best what I had for honourable mentions, another Standard eBooks production, Such Is Life by Joseph Furphy, which was a lot of fun. And believe it or not, another Standard eBooks one, which was Paradise Lost by John Milton, which I actually enjoyed enormously. It was well worth doing. And so that was quite a lot of fun. All right, that's my literary category, non-fiction category, non-genre category.
Okay, well, I had a pretty good year with the literary genre this year. Read 14 novels over a target of 12, and I'm got to list 10 of those 14.
Okay.
So that's not bad. First of them is To the Islands by Randolph Stowe. This was the winner of the 1958 Miles Franklin Award. The version that I read was his rewritten version from 1981, so I don't know how much it differs from the original. But it tells the story of an aging Anglican missionary somewhere in the Kimberley region who has a very disturbing confrontation with one of the native indigenous peoples in the mission in which he works, which basically throws his faith into a great deal of doubt. He's near the end of his life and he decides that he's had enough and he really needs to leave. So he flees the missionary and heads towards the mythical islands of death that the native Australians have a lot of myths about up in that particular area. And it's just a very wonderful, slow-moving, introspective novel about faith and the loss of it. You know, basically almost Graham Greene territory here. Really quite an excellent book. I haven't read anything more of Randolph Stowe, but I'm going to have to. He's a West Australian writer who is not very well known in Australian literary circles. He left Australia early and went and lived in the UK and died there about 10 years ago, I believe, but didn't write very much. He wrote about half a dozen novels, I think one of which is a science fiction novel set in Papua New Guinea, but don't quote me on that, but I think that's correct. But anyway, that was quite excellent. The second I've got is Possession by A.S. Byatt, winner of the 1990 Booker Prize. We discussed this earlier in the year, and you really enjoyed it as well when you read it.
Absolutely.
So I won't go into it in a great deal of detail. In fact, I won't go into it in any detail other than to say that I think it's probably one of the really good literary novels of the last 50 years, well, at least the ones that I've read. Third one, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which you may know about, Mark Haddon. I'm loath to say it's the first exploration of autism in a major literary novel, but it'd be pretty damn close, I would think. Dating from 2004, wasn't quite as good as when I first read it, but again, that's the same thing as we're talking about with when you go back and reread some books, they don't quite have the same impact. Possession did for me. This one, not quite as much, but still thought it was pretty good. Fourth one, The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. This one, in fact, made more of an impression on me than when I read it when I was in my teens or my 20s. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was a load of crock when I read it in my 20s. And now, reading in my old age and being of an age that's similar to the main character, it makes sense to me.
Right.
And I thought it was really good. So, again, it's just different perspectives.
Books you've got to be old enough to read, yeah.
Well, you've got to be old enough to read, but you've also got to be old enough to give yourself the opportunity of being able to say, well, okay, people are telling me this is good. I've got to give it another shot.
Mm-hmm.
It was excellent. It was really good. And the last one I have is The Plains, 1982, by Gerald Benane.
Yep.
Published by North Australia Press, which we hope to have a program about at sometime coming up in this year.
Yep.
If you haven't read this, have you?
I'm afraid I should.
Oh, no. Which is a bit sad because I really want to talk to somebody about it as to whether they feel that it's a science fiction novel or not. It seems to be set in a future Australia, where there are two major cultures, one inland, which is run by major large pastoralists who run their pastoral holdings like small countries, and then you've got the coastal band. The people on inland look down on those in the coast. You never get the view about what the coastal people are like, but those on inland seem to think that those on the coast are all hedonistic and not of much use. So it's a very interesting book and certainly worthwhile reading.
Oh, well, I promise you I'll read it this year and we can talk about it. It sounds good.
Well, you better read it before we actually talk about North Australia Press. Otherwise,
that's a good thought, yes.
Got to be in a bit of strife.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Honourable, Honourable mentions, some of these you'll probably know. Death in Venice, 1912 by Thomas Mann.
Yep.
Like that. Return of the Soldier by Rebecca West, 1918. She tells the story of her brother who refers... It's a woman living with her sister-in-law, and they're living in a house when her brother and her sister-in-law's husband, of course, comes back from the war. And it's written in 1918, and he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, shell shock and all the rest of it. And it, at the time it was written, it would have been quite a shocking book because he doesn't return a big hero, all-conquering, everything's absolutely fantastic. He's a broken man that's come back from the war, and he's suffering because of it. And the women around him also suffer emotional trauma because of his suffering. So it's quite an excellent exposition of this. Always, it's up in the, you know, sort of Google, The Guardian, 1001 books, 1000 best novels of all time, and 1001 books you should read before you die, novels you should read before you die. It's in there as well. It's really quite good. Third one, Remains of the Day, winner of the 89 Booker Prize by Kazuo Ishiguro, recent Nobel Prize winner from a couple of years back, made into a film with E.T., as I believe she's called, Emma Thompson, and what's his face? Was there?
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, excellent book, excellent film. It's not, it's sort of in a form of, told in the form from an unreliable narrator, but he's only unreliable because he doesn't realize he's unreliable.
Uh-huh.
He's not telling you lies. He's just telling you things as he sees them. But the novel is written in such a way that it gives you all this information in the background, even though it's told from his point of view. There's all these things going around, and you're going, he's missing the whole point of this, isn't he? And he just doesn't realize what's going on around him or what's happening. It's really quite excellent.
That's something I should read.
Very, very well done. Very well done. Fourth one of these, The Irishman, 1960 by Elizabeth O'Connor, winner of the 1960 Miles Franklin Award, coming of age story set in far north Queensland at the 1920s, at the time when the Teamsters, the bullock teams, were being phased out and cars were coming in. A very good coming of age novel. It's about the second or third Miles Franklin Award, I think. So she was the first female writer to win it. And the last one, which is one that I need to think about again and maybe skim back over and talk about sometime on the podcast. Night Boat to Tangier, 2019 by Kevin Barry. This is a short novel by an Irish writer, which comes across as like a noir version of Waiting for Godot.
Right.
Two blokes are sitting in a shipping port in the southern part of France, waiting for a ferry to come over from Tangier, on which they hope the daughter of one of them, who's been missing for 3 years, is going to appear. And these guys are sort of petty criminals. And it's beautifully written. It's just a cracker. It is really, really good. It almost snuck in. It almost snuck in on, knocked off, say, Curious Incident or The Plains. It was really, really excellent. So I had a good year with literary novels this year.
Indeed.
Really good.
Indeed.
Really good.
You having mentioned The Returned Soldier, reminds me, I should have added in as one of my honourable mentions, the book by a friend of ours, Jennifer Bryce, called Lily Campbell's Secret, which is also really about the wife of a returned soldier who has struggles when he comes back with brain damage. And so that certainly should have been in my list of honourable mentions for the year. All right, so now you read horror too. I never read horror, so I've got nothing in this category. Nothing in this category.
Nothing at all. Okay. Well, look, I only read four novels this year, so I'm only going to mention two that I read. One of them that I spoke about in the podcast, Experimental Film 2015 by Gemma Files. This is the Lady Midday, where basically the supernatural presence is basically a being that appears during the middle of the day and produces heat stroke in people. And it's one of those ones where I mentioned it was set in Canada, and it reads in some way like a genre of American Gods by Neil Gaiman, where the old gods from Europe have been brought over to the New World by the people that immigrated. So the same sort of concept, but done in a different way. Quite a good book. I really quite enjoyed it. The other one was Dr. Sleep by Stephen King from 2013. Finally caught up with this one. This is the sequel to The Shining. Not as good as The Shining, but worthwhile. Look, Stephen King always writes a good book.
He does.
You can always find something pretty good in it. But I think over the last couple of years with this one, and I've just finished reading The Outsider, which I believe you've read as well, he's producing competent, good books, which most people would believe would be a really fantastic piece of work that they produce. But for Stephen King, it's not up with his best work anymore. I think he's hit a peak and he's plateaued.
No, he's probably allowed to. He's probably allowed to.
Well, right I would have thought so after all this time. But is it to say that it isn't to say they're bad books by any stretch of the imagination or they're not worthwhile reading. They're just not at the top of the Stephen King list.
Can do,
that's
yeah.
All.
Yeah.
So that was it. Just four books read, no honourable mentions.
Sure.
And there we are.
Okay. I mean, I say I never read horror, but I've read a couple of Stephen King's, which I enjoyed. So,
Well, The Outsider's a horror novel.
Yeah, I think you're right. It probably fits into that category.
It starts off, but we won't go into this.
But
too
it,
much.
It could be science fiction, it could be fantasy, it could be. Yeah, it's very hard to.
It could be a
distinguish
partly
between
crime
these.
Novel, but we'll talk about it.
Yeah, partly a crime novel because it's the fourth in that series of I've forgotten the name of the character, but
Bill Hodges.
Bill Hodges, yeah, which starts off as a crime series, and but it keeps going from there, and now
it
ends up in this sort of fantasy realm.
Else.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
So, what have we got next week? Well, we have crime listed next. Crime thriller. I bundle everything together. So I've got crime, spy, thriller, all in one in mind. So you have to figure that out when I go, and I won't try to put these in order. But one of the books I read, which I did enjoy quite a lot, was The Woman in the Window by A.J. Finn, which is a thriller with an interesting sort of premise. The protagonist is a woman who's trapped in her own home because she has crippling agoraphobia, and she can't even go out into her own backyard without having a panic attack. She's separated from her husband and her teenage daughter, and so she lives alone, apart from visits from a physiotherapist and some telephone contact with her psychologist. She spends a lot of time on the internet playing online chess and learning French. So it's not surprising that she spends a lot of time looking out of the window and observing the lives of her neighbours. And one day she's visited by a new neighbour who's very friendly with her, and she spends a long afternoon with her, an enjoyable afternoon with her. But one evening, some days later, this woman, the protagonist, looks out of the window and sees this new woman being stabbed in her home across the park and collapsing. Tries to run across the park between these two houses. But her agoraphobia cripples her and she collapses. So I won't go into any more detail, but it's cleverly done. Several interesting twists in the plot, and it's a pretty satisfying sort of book. But as a little appendix to this, there's actually a shocking expose of the author of this book, A.J. Finn, in the New Yorker in February 2019. His real name is Dan Mallory, and it seems that he's been a serial fabulist about the details of his own life. He's kind of a real-life Tom Ripley, charming but outrageous liar. So it was very interesting to read that article after having read the book. But still, it doesn't detract from the book itself, which I thought was very enjoyable. Then what do I have? Let me think. Another standard ebooks production, Lady Audley's Secret by Mary Braddon. And this was suggested to me really by Lucy Sussex when we interviewed her some time ago. She was the equivalent in England of the of Australian writers like Ellen Davitt and Mary Fortune and Fergus Hume. She was writing at the same sort of time, and Lady Audley's Secret was her most successful book, and apparently it made her an absolute fortune, which is fine for her. Again, I won't get into all the details of the plot; it would take too long. But I really enjoyed reading that and producing it for standard ebooks. So that was fun. And then I think I've got this is definitely a spy thriller, a book called Moskva, or Moscow really, pronounced as the Moscowese would pronounce it, I suppose. Moskva by Jack Grimwood. I don't know whether you've read this, Perry, but it was a good thriller, basically set in Moscow. The protagonist is a British diplomat, essentially a spy, but a British diplomat. And he's brought in when the daughter of the ambassador vanishes. And nobody's quite sure whether she's been kidnapped or whether she's come to some harm in some way. And so he's out to investigate and find her. So I very much enjoyed that. It was very gripping, and the ending wasn't predictable. It was a good book. And apparently Jack Grimwood was actually mainly known as, his full name is John Courtney Grimwood. And he's primarily a science fiction writer. He's been nominated many times for the British Science Fiction Award. And he won for his novel End of the World Blues in 2006. Yeah, interesting. But personally, I'm hoping he'll keep writing thrillers. There's another book of this type that he's written, which I'm not sure if it's a sequel or just a similar sort of book, called Nightfall Berlin, which is on my to-be-read list. So I'm looking forward to reading that. And then my last two books, which are, if I were ranking them, would be first and second, are two books by Candice Fox, starting with Crimson Lake, and the second one was Redemption Point. In point of fact, the third book in that trilogy I've just finished reading this year, which is called Gone by Midnight. Now, they're all crackers of books. They're all set in a place called Crimson Lake, which is a little town outside of Cairns in northern Queensland. And the interest really is the protagonist, and well, the characters really, but the protagonist is a guy who was a cop but was falsely accused of abducting and raping a young girl. Witnesses sort of saw him at a bus stop where the girl was last seen. But he, in fact, is innocent of the crime, but is never fully cleared because the evidence... there's not enough evidence to put him in jail, but there's not enough other evidence to clear his name. And so he's one of the most hated men in Australia. It's sort of the public has sort of taken against him, a bit like people did with Lindy Chamberlain, I think. And so his marriage breaks up. He has to leave his wife and child because his wife leaves him. He flees to this remote town in northern Queensland. But of course, everybody soon finds out who he is and makes his life a hell. But he gets caught up with a young woman there called Amanda Farrell, who runs a detective agency or a private investigators agency. She's a very weird character herself. But they work together to solve crimes. And I thought this was really good. The characters are good. The plots are very good. The surprising twists to them. So she's a great writer. I'll be looking forward to reading some more of her books in the future. So that's good. So that's my category there. Some honourable mentions: The Scholar by Dervla McTiernan, The Cold, Cold Ground by Adrian McKinty, The Lost Man by Jane Harper, and another book by Adrian McKinty, I Hear the Sirens in the Street. They were all good, but didn't quite make my top five list for the year. How about you, Perry?
We have some synergies here, oddly enough. Uh-huh. Ah, yes. Well, we'll get there. You'll find them as we go. The first of mine is Sands of Windy, 1931 novel by Arthur Upfield. This is the second in the Boney series of novels. He's a part Caucasian, part Indigenous Australian detective who utilises his Indigenous background to solve crimes in and around, say, those areas of the outback of Australia where basically the Europeans and the Indigenous peoples are interacting, generally in a way which means that the Europeans are controlling everything and the Indigenous peoples are being treated like dirt. Mm-hmm. In this instance, though, I keep thinking all the time, it's only the second one of his that I've read, and I'm interested to keep on reading them, and I keep looking for them thinking I'm going to be annoyed by the way he treats the Indigenous Australians. And so far, after two books, I'm not. Mm-hmm. I think he's got a very, very sympathetic view of them. He understands the hardships they were going through, because he lived out in the country a lot, and of some of the work that I've been doing indexing some newspapers recently, I've been coming across some travel writing of his set in the areas in which these novels are set. And so the whole thing's very interesting. And anyway, I think that we need to discuss this particular book specifically at some time on the podcast, because as a result of this particular book, a murder was committed. And the court, in the court case, Arthur Upfield, the author of this book, was brought in as a witness for the prosecution to describe how he came about with the method of disposal of a body. I won't go into anything further, but this is, the more and more I think about this, this is a real seminal crime novel in Australian history, and needs to be thought about and talked about a fair bit more. So we will do that sometime in the year coming up.
I'll have to read it then. Yep.
You will have to read it.
I will.
The second book is The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yes, oh yes.
You mentioned Tom Ripley just a minute ago.
I did.
And then I'm going, oh, I'm just about laughing, almost said something. But anyway, 1955, The Year of My Birth by Patricia Highsmith. This is a really good book. Really good book. I don't know whether any of the film versions that have been made of it have done it justice, but it's really good. And Tom Ripley is a real bastard. Mm-hmm. He really is. But told from his point of view, he becomes almost a sympathetic bastard, and you can understand what he's doing. And you don't have to like him. And this is the interesting thing. He's a protagonist, main character in the book, and you really just don't like him. But you feel compelled to keep on reading the book. It's good. It's mm-hmm. it's a fine piece of work. Third one, Kill Shot from 2018 by Gary Disher. This is the ninth in his Wyatt series of novels. Gary Disher is an Australian writer, writes crime novels, has won a number of Ned Kelly Awards. The Wyatt novels are really, really quite good, quite excellent. He's a thief. He's a burglar. He makes his money by stealing things and fencing them. And he's having to change with the times. I think the first Wyatt novels were written 25-odd years ago, prior to the full flush of technology that we have now. And as the technology has got further and further along and people are using more of it to protect their gear, he can't large masses of money is now not moving around as much as it used to, or if it is, it's being tracked all over the place, much harder to steal. So he has to find different ways of actually making his money, and he's succeeding, and he's doing very well, Disher. He's been writing, he must be in his 70s by now, but he's still putting out some very excellent books. Mm. Fourth one, The Lost Man, which you mentioned in your honourable mentions,
yep.
By Jane Harper, the third novel by her, but the first one of its type. I thought this was really interesting as I saw a number of connections between this and the Upfield novel that I mentioned.
Uh-huh.
So that was a nice connection that I saw, it felt in my head as I was going. Other people may not see them as well as I did, but I read those two books within a 12-month period and felt that there was a direct connection, but it's certainly a psychic one from my perspective anyway, sort of got there. And the last one is Redemption Point by Candace Fox. So you and I have both got to the point where we both really like Candace Fox's
she's
work.
Good, yeah.
She's really quite excellent and turning out. So that's four Australian novels and one non-Australian novel. So that's not bad.
Not bad at all.
In terms of those for the top five.
Yeah.
My honourable mentions will give you a bit of an idea about a bit of a pointer as to what else I'm doing when I'm reading. Going back, rereading a lot of books from the past that I may have read before, but now rereading for the last time or reading for the very first time. So I started the Aurelio Zen series by Michael Dibden. The first one's called Rat King, 1989. These books are set in Rome, in the Aurelio Zen is a Venetian police detective who's working for the Rome Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, he's looked down upon because he's Venetian, and therefore, he's not in the upper reaches of Roman politics because it's all politics in Italy. But Dibdin's was, unfortunately, he's no longer with us. Dibdin's was an English writer, so he's writing these books set in the Rome Police Department. Quite good. I'll probably try and get to one of those a year. The second of mine is The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay. This is a novel where her detective is lying in bed and with a broken leg. Somebody brings him a postcard from the National Portrait Gallery of Richard III. So he tries to set out in his bed to solve the mystery of the Princess in the Tower. This is one of the all-time classic crime novels. Great when I first read it, but again, reading it for the second time, I go, yeah, okay, I've got heard of this before. So unfortunately, second time reading through, it doesn't quite rise up. Third one, Postman Always Rings Twice by James M. McCain, noir novel of misguided love in the Midwest of the US, been made into a film with Jack Nicholson in the lead role. Good book. Rogue Mail, 1939, by Jeffrey Household. Another one that is considered to be quite important. It tells the story of a man who attempts to kill the leader of a Bavarian nation in 1939 or 1938. Never actually named, I don't think, but it's obviously Adolf Hitler. And then he escapes, he gets caught, captured, he escapes, he gets back to England and attempts to evade capture by the Germans, who have got secret agents in the UK looking for him. Excellent book. And the last one is The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we need to talk about The Maltese Falcon. It's a fantastic book, fantastic film. Good to see that some of the lines from the book are directly transcribed into the film. I like to drink with a man that knows how to drink. I like to talk with a man that knows how to talk. Lovely lines, fantastic stuff. A really good classic crime novel. So most of the honourable mentions for my crime were for me reading back over old crime novels from the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, there you go.
Good stuff. No, that's good stuff.
No, there's certainly some good stuff from back in that area, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and then the best thriller spies, I only read three and had a target of 8, so I didn't do very well on this one. But the ones that I've in my best of for the year for these, only two of them. Smiley's People from 1979 by John le Carré, which we talked about great length at the in the podcast.
Yep.
The third of the Quest for Carla series. And the other one is The Chain by Adrian McKinty, which I thought was an excellent thriller. Again, we've discussed this during the year. It'll be absolutely made into a film. You can guarantee that. Maybe made into a TV series or into a film. And it's going to win prizes in 2020 for books published in 2019. Guarantee it. It's a bestseller all over the place. I really enjoyed it. I know some people didn't enjoy it as much as I did, but I thought it was great.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I know, actually, you're one of them.
I didn't much like it. I thought disappointing because I'd read the other couple of other of his books, which I thought were pretty good. But this one, I thought
Sean Duffy series is really good.
Yeah,
really,
it's good. But I didn't. I just the chain didn't quite. Not sure what it was. It wasn't convincing somehow to me. Just the way people reacted and the way that the situation unfolded. So I was a bit disappointed. I actually had gone out and bought a paperback because it looked so good and been reviewed so well. But it's okay. Yeah. But it certainly wasn't on my list of best books of the year. So
different strokes, different folks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a matter of taste. That's fair.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The next one I've got on my list, this genre I've got on my list is young adult. Now, yep. I originally wasn't going to include that category, but I will. I'll say outright, I think that the best in that category for me this year was The Secret Commonwealth by Philip Pullman, which is... it's a bit hard to talk about because it's the second in a trilogy, which trilogy is a sequel to his previous trilogy called His Dark Materials, which started with Northern Lights, or sometimes known as the Golden Compass. So this is a second trilogy in the same universe. So it's impossible to talk about it without going into detail about the previous trilogy, I think. But it was certainly my best read in that category this year. But following that was a trilogy by another Philip Reeve, and this is the Fever Crumb trilogy. The character's name is Fever Crumb, and it's set in the same universe or same timeline, if you like, as his tetralogy, The Mortal Engines series of books. And this is it has this kind of absurd concept, which he manages to bring off. This absurd concept that cities in the future have become mobile on huge traction engines, and they roam the plains hunting down smaller towns for spare parts and so on. And it's an absurd concept, but he makes it work. It's very entertaining, certainly from a young adult point of view. It's extremely entertaining, really interesting characters. And this Fever Crumb trilogy is, in fact, a prequel to what happens in the Mortal Engines series. And it's set in a time before the cities have become mobile. And it kind of leads up to why they become mobile. And the main character is this young woman who has been adopted by a scientist, Dr. Crumb. And the background is that there used to be this race of mutant humans called the Skriven, called the Skriven because they have markings on their bodies. And they believe in this god, if you like, called the Scrivener, and they believe that the markings on their bodies are, you know, God's message to mark them out as being special. But they've declined in power. In fact, they've had trouble reproducing, and they've declined in power, and have just been tossed out of London at the point where the first book, Fever Crumb, starts up. And Fever Crumb has been found abandoned and adopted by Dr. Crumb. And there's a slight suspicion that she might be part Scriven, but the Scriven are sort of treated as, by the ordinary people as being these horrible oppressors for all these years. And so any hint that you were related to the Scriven means that you're under suspicion and probably going to get in big trouble. But anyway, without following a lot of the detail, they're really, really entertaining books, I think. And it takes this. If you follow this character and her development, and she starts off as being someone who's been raised by engineers, and therefore is absolutely committed to everything being logical and scientific, and you know, emotion is to be discarded and not considered. But of course, through the series of these books, she eventually starts to discover that you can't just abandon that part of yourself and have to start to dealing with relationships with other people in something other than a logical way. So they're very much recommended. So those three books are Fever Crumb, which is the first one. The next one is called A Web of Air, which is kind of about trying to rediscover heavier-than-air flight, which has been forgotten. And the third one is called Scrivener's Moon. And they're all very dramatic and very, very entertaining. So I enjoyed those. Do I have any honourable mentions? Not really. I did read Every Heart a Doorway, which I talked about. Again, I found that a little bit disappointing, so it didn't quite hit my list. So that's my young adult category.
Oh, I've only got two in mine. The first one is Gifts from 2004 by Ursula K. Le Guin. Uh-huh. This is the first in the Annals of the Western Shore trilogy, basically set in a fantastic world where certain people have certain supernatural gifts which allow them to call animals or set things aflame or burst things asunder. And different families seem to have different powers which are passed down through generations. And as long as they can keep the bloodlines relatively secure, the power will continue. And it tells the story of a couple of young children who have powers, and how they go about dealing with the knowledge of those. And in particular, one of them has the power to be able to obliterate and burst things asunder. And he finds that he can't control it when he is angry, and he lashes out and he can't work out how to control it. And he realizes that he only destroys things that he can see. So he gets his father to put his eyes out so that he won't have the possibility of being able to destroy the things he loves.
Mm.
And it's what he how he has to deal with that and how he has to come to that decision when he's like 12 or 13.
Mm.
It's quite an interesting book, quite a good coming of age novel. It's the first in three, and you can always guarantee if Le Guin's written it, it's going to be of excellent quality.
Sure.
And harrowing in some ways, but uplifting in others, and certainly worthwhile carrying on and going to the rest of it, I believe. So I'll be getting to that, the next one or two of that in the coming year. Mm. The other one is Green Witch by Susan Cooper.
Oh, yes.
Yep, which is the third in the Darkest Rising sequence. Hard to describe what this is about, but it's set in sort of, well, it's written in 1974, so it's set at a commensurate time in England where the dark powers are attempting to make one of their regular reappearances on the earth, and there are a number of people who are attempting to put them to keep them in check. One young boy has a power that he wasn't aware of, that he is gradually learning to be able to use, that will help people to keep those the dark powers in check. I think there are five.
I think so, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Five books in the sequence. So I've got a couple more to read. They're good stuff.
They're all very good, yeah.
Oh, they're all very good. He's a very good writer. No honourable mentions. So just those.
Okay. Now, you, I think, want to just talk about anthologies and so on and Singer other collections.
Yeah, I've just got a couple or three anthologies, which I really should talk about a bit more often at some point. But it's hard to get to how to talk about an anthology really without going into massive amounts of detail, because each of these books are all about 600 to 700 pages long. They've each got about 40 to 50 stories of various lengths in them. Some of them have novellas. And some novelettes and short stories, some just novelettes and short stories. The three that I've read were, three that I've got that I mentioned that I really liked were The Year's Best Science Fiction, 33rd Annual Collection from 2016, edited by Gardner Dozois, which covers short fiction published in 2015. This goes back to my point about trying to read back over the short fiction for particular years, and I'm using the Year's Best Short Fiction anthologies for a year to catch up, which is a good way of doing it. You get a good overview about what was going on in that particular year. The next one is The Best Science Fiction of the Year, Volume 2 from 1917, edited by Neil Clark, which covers short SF published in 2016. And the last one is The Best SFNF of the Year, Volume 11, 2017, which also covers short SF published in 2016. That's edited by Jonathan Strawn, who lives in Perth. Now, the first two of those cover purely science fiction. The last one covers science fiction and fantasy. So if you read those three, not only will you read something like 2,000 pages of fiction, but you'll also get a good view about what's happening in those two particular years. The Clark and the Strawn, because they cover the same year, do have some overlap, but it's only half a dozen stories generally of out of the 40 or so that are there. So I think these are good ways to get a view about what short science fiction's like in the field.
The only thing I can contribute to this category is yet again another production for Standard eBooks, which was a collection of the short fiction of H.G. Wells, which was very interesting to put together. The production, the edition I did for Standard eBooks, contains no less than 54 Wells stories, so I had to read all of these as part of the production, and it's quite hard work reading that many stories by one author, I can tell you. But it's quite interesting. I mean, the collections that they came from were published between 1894 and 1909. Which is an interesting period of time, of course. And so the stories kind of vary widely, and they range from absolutely straightforward tales of domestic romance to ghost stories, tropical adventures, far future science fiction. And many of the stories, the earlier stories, deal with the exciting and frightening prospect of heavier-than-air flight an aerial warfare, which was pending at the time when Wells started writing. And quite a few of his stories deal with the coming future of aerial warfare and aerial flight. He's really quite worried about the prospect, I think, and probably right to be so too. So that was interesting. So that was the only anthology I read during the year.
Well, the single author collection, which I would put that as a single author collection rather than an anthology. By anthologies here, I mean that they're edited by somebody bringing together stories by a vast number of different authors all coming into the one volume.
Yep.
Single author volumes are volumes of stories, various lengths, where all the stories are by one particular author.
Yeah, you're right. That's how I should have categorised it. Yep.
I only read four in the year. Target was six, because I think, again, you get a good view of, especially in the science fiction and fantasy world, where a lot of authors do write a lot of short fiction. You get a good view about what an author is like, what their style's like, and you can get a view of them before you invest in either money and time for purchasing a novel to give that a try. So worthwhile checking out some of these short single author collections. The three that I've got here are The Overneath, 2017 by Peter S. Beagle. I spoke about Beagle earlier on in terms of the Summer Long and also The Last Unicorn, good writer. The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories by Ken Liu. The Paper Menagerie, the lead story in this particular collection, is quite excellent. And he has some quirky little short stories in this. Quite good stuff. Ken Liu is now writing novels, very, very long, 1,000-page fantasy novels. Is also known as being a proponent of Chinese science fiction, and he's doing a lot of translations of that and getting it published in the US and in the Western world. He was the one that translated The Three Body Problem.
Yes.
Which won the Hugo Award a few years back. Mm. And so that's a big push along. Barack Obama liked that book. So if you haven't read it, you better get to it, David, if you're going to follow everything that he recommends.
Are we talking about the three body solution?
The three body problem.
I've definitely read that. Yeah.
And the last one here is The Custodians and Other Stories, 1978 by Richard Cowper. Went back and reread this. I'd read it a long time ago. He's a good writer. Sadly missed. Enjoy his stuff. Very much forgotten these days, which is a bit sad, really. But there we go. Mm.
All right. Well, my next genre on the list is nonfiction. This is my last category, I think. Oh, you want to talk about novellas? You want to talk about novellas first?
I'll just go quickly through the novellas, because most of these I basically spoke about at some point during the year. Read 18 of them during the year. First one's Rogue Protocol by Martha Wells. That was the third in the Murderbot Diaries. I also liked Exit Strategy, which was the fourth in the Murderbot Diaries. That was from 2019. The one that I took out as a did I have it? No, I didn't even have it as an honourable mention, because I thought it was the weakest of the lot, was the one that won the Hugo Award. Mm-hmm. So it goes to show you I don't really know anything at all. The other ones that I liked this year were Time Was by Ian MacDonald. Excellent time travel novella about a homosexual love affair between two blokes that is carried out across the 20th century, where they seem to be tracking each other and they seem to be travelling in time at different rates, but meeting up with each other via messages they leave in books in a particular secondhand bookstore somewhere in London. Mm. Quite excellent. Yeah, really well done.
That does look interesting, yeah.
The other one's Perihelion Summer by Greg Egan, West Australian author, which I've discussed a bit. I think I discussed this one with us in the podcast earlier. Yep. I think Egan's better at the shorter length than he is at the longer. And the other one is Permafrost by Alastair Reynolds, a novel set in the Antarctic. There are a number of honourable mentions. The one that I'll mention most, the only one that I'll bring up is The Churn by James S.A. Corey, which is an Expanse novella. You were talking about the Expanse novel earlier. This is a 2014 novella. Had never got around to reading it. And it tells the story of how Amos came to be who and what he is. Quite good.
Excellent.
Really quite good. Fills in some good background.
Excellent.
So your non-fiction.
My next category, and it's the last category people will be relieved to know, no doubt, is non-fiction.
Well, we're going to do our best overall at the end.
We'll do our best overall. That won't take long. The first one I've got in the list was a book called Blockbuster, Fergus Hume and the Mystery of a Hansom Cab by Lucy Sussex, who was a friend of ours and who we interviewed in episode 14. And so we won't talk much about this, but it's a very detailed and well-researched biography, and not so much of Fergus Hume himself, but a biography of his novel, The Mystery of a Hansom Cab. And so that was and how it became such a huge bestseller around the world in the late Victorian era. So that was good. The next one I've got is a book called Doing Justice by Preet Bharara. Hope I pronounced that right. Preet Bharara was the federal district attorney for the Southern District of New York. And after meeting with the new president, Donald Trump, in which Trump asked him to stay on, he later rejected Trump's overtures seeking loyalty to Trump himself personally and was fired. But he's made a new career for himself as a very successful podcaster. And in this book, Doing Justice, he talks about his long experience in the law and how it's applied in the United States. How does one ensure that justice is done? When should the case be prosecuted and when let go? What's a fair system of punishment? How can prisons work in a way which doesn't degrade both prisoners and guards? So it's beautifully written, very well done. Recommend that. Got another Stanley Books production, which is actually a reread, I have to say, which was South by Ernest Shackleton, which if you've never read before, I certainly recommend. It's a terrific true life adventure story of the way that his expedition to the South Pole played out. His ship, the Endeavour, was trapped in the ice and eventually breaks up, and the crew have to abandon on this ice floe, and they have to trek across the floating ice to months at a time, finally to reach an island, and then they're abandoned on this island, and they have to figure out how they're going to try and get help from the outside world. It's a great story, very well written, and it's all true. Great stuff. Next one is Eggshell Skull by Bri Lee. Which I read right at the beginning of the year. It was almost the first book I read this year, in 2019, I should say. And it's by a young woman who gets involved in the legal system. She studies the law and gets involved as an assistant to a judge. And they travel around Queensland and hear cases, and she helps him with the cases. But a lot of the cases he deals with are to do with rape or child sexual abuse. And she becomes very disenchanted with the whole system, although she really respects the judge she works for. But she also has a personal story, as unfortunately so many women do, of sexual abuse when she was a child. I think she was 10 or 11. She decides on the basis of what she's studied that despite how the legal system discriminates against women in these circumstances, that she's going to fight her case and bring her perpetrated to justice. And it's a great story, very well written, again, Australian story, very, very well worth reading. And the last book is one which has a bit of a personal connection to me, which is called A Mind Unraveled by Kurt Eichenbach, who's an American journalist. And it tells his story of growing up and becoming very badly afflicted with epilepsy as a teenager, and how he doesn't let it ruin his life, but he has to fight against the medical system, poorly educated doctors. His school tries to throw him out because he has fits, and he fights against all of that with the help of his parents, and eventually grows up as an adult and has a family and has a now successful career. But it's very, very interesting story. It reads like a novel in many ways, and It's a very personal story, but a very good one. And I have a personal connection with it in that my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, also had epilepsy, and it really did. It was in the era when people didn't know how to treat it properly, and it was very much considered people couldn't talk about it, and you were very much ostracized for having this illness. And so it really did ruin his life. And so that's my personal connection. So those were all great books. Just one quick honorable mention, and that was Uncle Tungsten by Oliver Sacks, which is a story of a chemical boyhood, which is about his growing up years and his fascination with science and his various uncles who were involved in science or sort of scientific industry. It's well worth reading that book too. So that's a good book. So that's my nonfiction.
Okay. I was the same, that the first book I read in the year of 2019 was one that ended up on this list, and that is On Writing by Stephen King.
Oh, yes.
This is a cracker of a book in terms of giving you the ideas of how basically the whole concept of writing works, which is, and King's, we've discussed him a couple of times already in this this particular podcast. He's a fantastic technician, whether you like his work or not. He certainly knows how to tell a story, and he knows what works and what doesn't work. And so that's an excellent book. Second one, Born to Run from 2016. This is Bruce Springsteen's autobiography. I have to admit to being a long-term Bruce Springsteen fan from the mid-70s. I'd had this book for a while, hadn't actually got around to reading it, and few people that I know had told me that I really should read it, and I was pretty much blown away when I did read it. I knew the guy could write songs, but I didn't know he could write prose as well as this. He's really, really good. And this is the autobiography where you probably don't follow Springsteen as closely as I do.
I'm afraid not.
But this is the one where he let it be known that he's had a lifelong problem with depression and that he's been receiving help for it for quite some time. And he talks about the early times when it started to impact him, and he got over that when he was younger, and then in his middle age it just came on with like a roller coaster, and he didn't know what the hell to do. But he got himself through it, and he still suffers, but he's learned to live with it. And it's really quite an interesting book about the rock and roll lifestyle and what it does to you and how it affects you and your family. And it's excellent stuff.
Good.
I don't know whether, if you're not a Springsteen fan, this would be as interesting, but to me, it was fantastic. Mm. Third one is Saga Land from 2017 by Carrie Gislason and Richard Feidler. Mm-hmm. Richard Feidler's a ABC Sydney radio host, and his friend Carrie Gislason is an Icelandic man who lives in Brisbane. Two of them got talking. Feidler was a big fan of Iceland, and they ended up deciding, well, Gislason decided that he wanted to go back and trace his family roots in Iceland. Feidler decided that he wanted to go to Iceland for the first time. And I read this because I went to Iceland. I read this before I went to Iceland this year. Fantastic introduction to the country, the history and the myths. Really worthwhile reading. The next one is Underland by Robert McFarlane, which is turning up in a lot of best of the year books this year. It's a collection of essays that he has written about his journeys into the worlds under the Earth's surface. Mm. So he talks about going into glacial tunnels, lava tubes, going down into a dark matter mine where they've converted a gold mine into a dark matter observatory. He talks about going into underground limestone and water sequences of tunnels and caverns, and also into the catacombs under Paris. Mm. Really excellent exposition and discussion of what the world is like beneath our feet. Really, really good stuff. Mm. The last one I've got is The Shelf Life of Zora Cross, autobiography of Zora Cross, the Australian poet. Much forgotten these days. I'm a big fan of her work. And this was a very, very excellent book about Zora Cross, how she came to be a big, bright, shining light in the late 1910s. And then by 1938, it had pretty much completely faded out from everybody's view. Kathy Perkins, the Australian academic, basically digs into her life and discusses why she rose and why she fell. It's very interesting. It deals with the Australian literary scene from the 1910s, 20s and 30s, and it's quite good. And my honourable mention, of course, is Blockbuster Lucy Sussex, which we discussed pretty heavily, which I thought was quite good. Just couldn't quite squeeze it in to the top five, unfortunately.
Fair enough.
There we go.
Fair enough.
So there we are.
Right. So we've been running for an hour and 40 minutes now, Lee, so we better wind up fairly soon, but let's keep going. So best overall. I think it's pretty straightforward for me. The best book I read throughout the year, I think, has got to be The Sudden Appearance of Hope by Claire North. I could read it again today and really enjoyed it. I loved it to little pieces. So, yeah, definitely my best book of the year. Second in my list was Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton, which I read right at the beginning of the year. Also great. Next book, All the Light We Cannot See, which I've talked about. The next one was The First 15 Lives of Harry North. Harry August. Two books on the list. The First 15 Lives of Harry August, I should have said. And the last one was the non-fiction book I've just talked about, A Mind Unraveled by Kurt Eichenbach. And with honourable mentions to Eggshell Skull, The Choke, which I haven't actually mentioned in my literary list, but never mind, The Choke is very good. The Power by Naomi Alderman, Middlemarch by George Eliot, and The Secret Commonwealth. So that was my list.
Okay, my best overall, Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, Possession by A.S. Byatt, The Lost Man by Jane Harper, The Chain by Adrian McKinty, mm-hmm. and Underland by Robert McFarlane.
No.
I didn't come up with any honourable mentions, just those top five, not in any particular order, just purely reading order. Mm. But look, I thought I had a good reading year, came across some good stuff. You obviously were quite impressed by Claire North.
Oh, absolutely. So got to read all the books.
Well, I reckon if you could find one or two good authors every year that you hadn't come across before, that you're absolutely desperate to read the rest of the books by them, you've done pretty damn well for the year. And so you sound like you've got there.
Yeah, I've done that with Candice Fox and with Claire North. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to reading future books by those two writers. In terms of looking forward, so I can tell that we need to wrap up soon. In terms of looking forward to next year, I had a list which I'm looking for now. So the books I'm looking forward to in 2020 are The Mirror and the Light by Hilary Mantel, and that's going to be the third book in her trilogy about Thomas Cromwell. The first two books were terrific, starting with Wolf Hall and followed by Bring Up the Bodies. There's another book coming out by Susanna Clarke, who wrote Jonathan Strange, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is probably just about my best book of all time, almost. So I'm really looking forward to that. And this is called Piranesi, which is going to be very interesting to see what that's about. There's another book coming out by Dervla McTiernan called The Good Turn. So her books have been good.
So that's number three, isn't it?
Yes, that'll be her third book.
Oh, God, I'm so far behind.
There's another book coming out by Trent Dalton, who wrote Boy Swallows Universe, called All Our Shimmering Skies, which sounds very interesting. And, of course, I'm hoping that there'll be another book in the Expanse series, which will be the final one, I believe, the ninth book in the Expanse series. And I'm hoping that Philip Pullman will manage to bring out the third book in his Book of Dust trilogy, which is the second one about the universe of from his Dark Materials. So those are my look forward tos.
I haven't got any specific ones listed that are coming out for next year. Didn't do the research to look into which ones were coming out and what was there. But I can say that I'm looking forward to going in and continuing some of those series of books that I've started to get into, like the Boney series of books, that's the Arthur Upfield. I want to catch up on so many other books. You've piqued my interest in Claire North again now that you've basically spoken about her. I've read the two that you're talking about, but there's three or four others that I really need to catch up on. End of Days is one of them. And there's vast numbers of books. I've probably, as I said, I've got a target now of 102 for next year. I certainly have to try and catch up on a few Pulitzer Prize winners, Man Booker Prize winners, Miles Franklin Award winners, just to spread the range of books that I read. I don't know whether I've mentioned this on the podcast previously, but I look at the idea of a reading life is a bit like the reading material that you have is a bit like food for the soul. And so the books you read, you should think of as being like food. There are sometimes when what you're absolutely desperate for is a good pizza, you know, the best pizza you can get, a good Lee Child novel that's going to sit down and just going to go like a roller coaster and over and done within a day or two, and that's fine. And sometimes you want to sit down to a sumptuous banquet, but you don't want to do that all the time. So you have to have a good overview, a good diet of material that you're going to be reading. And so the wider you read, the better off you are. And you start to see connections between things, like the connections I saw between Lost Man and the Upfield novel. So it's good that you can get all of this. And that's what I'm looking forward to continue that exploration of the different types of books that I've heard about. I like the idea of the Shackleton book that you were talking about, and a couple of others that piqued my interest, and I'll have to try and get to.
And they're all available free through Standard Ebooks.
That's absolutely fantastic. Oh, what a fantastic price! But Shackleton is a very, very interesting character, and one that I should do a bit more research into and have a bit of a look at. I think it's probably a very good thing. One final note that I would like to make.
Okay.
The book Underland, which deals with the world underneath, mentions a book that I had read earlier than reading Underland, and that is Rogue Male by Geoffrey Household.
All right.
Oddly enough, I think it's probably about the only novel that he mentions in the whole of the book, but he does mention that one.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting. Yeah. Quite interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've been talking for an awfully long time, so we should probably wind up and not test the patience of our listener.
Our listener. Yes, our listener's probably fast asleep by now snoring.
All right. So thanks, Perry. We'll wind it up there, and we'll be back in another couple of weeks.
Okay, David, talk to you then.
See you then.
See you.
Bye. Thanks. Bye.